From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last week, Caspar Weinberger was indicted for concealing his knowledge of the Iran-Contra affair. The 30-page indictment also mentions George Bush and Ronald Reagan. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss this new development in the Iran-Contra investigation with Tom Blanton, executive director of the National Security Archive. Also, we'll talk to the woman the Los Angeles Times describes as the most powerful advocate in America for children. Miriam Wright Edelman is the founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund. And our commentator Maureen Corrigan, who's usually a professor of English at Georgetown University, has enrolled as a student for the summer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court overturned a closely watched hate crime law today. The justices invalidated a law from St. Paul, Minnesota, because it imposed special punishments on people who express bigoted views. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
2 years ago, a bunch of teenagers burned a cross in the yard of a black family who'd recently moved into the neighborhood. One of the teenagers was prosecuted under the St. Paul hate crime law, which bans placing symbols on private or public property when those symbols arouse resentment in others based on race, color, creed, religion, or gender. The state Supreme Court construed the statute to prohibit only expressions known as fighting words. Today, the Supreme Court said that even using that limiting analysis of the local law, the ordinance is an unconstitutional violation of First Amendment rights of free expression because it punishes only people who express themselves in a disfavored way on the subject of race, color, creed, or gender. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
A top United Nations negotiator said today that there's been some progress in talks on how to end the UN oil embargo against Iraq. John Domenico Pico has been meeting with Iraqi representatives in Vienna, and he told reporters that agreement has been reached on a lot of key points. Pico said that negotiators for both sides must now take the agreement back to their respective governments for consultation. He declined to give details until after he's briefed the UN Security Council. The council agreed last September to allow Iraq to sell up to $1.6 billion worth of oil to pay for humanitarian supplies. Iraq rejected the plan several times, charging that it was a violation of Iraqi sovereignty. In Bosnia, 8 people were killed and 80 wounded during a mortar attack on shoppers in the capital city, Sarajevo. Pierre Vickery reports that the incident occurred as Serbian artillery batteries in the hills around the capital stepped up their shelling of the city.
The deadly mortar attack took place in mid-morning in the center of Sarajevo as thousands of civilians risked the Serbian bombardment to hunt for food. 3 shells slammed into a crowd of shoppers, killing 5 people outright and leaving others in a pool of blood. Ambulance crews were prevented from reaching the disaster area by sniper fire and the continued Serbian artillery barrage. A doctor at Sarajevo Hospital described the shelling as the worst of its kind since people online for bread came under fire a month ago. The new wave of bombing will further delay efforts by the United Nations to reopen the city's airport to bring food and medicines to tens of thousands of civilians besieged and bombarded for nearly 3 months. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 4 points to close at 3,280.8. Declines led advances by a margin of almost 2-to-1 in active trading of about 169 million shares. This is NPR. The State Department has welcomed the election of Fidel Ramos as president of the Philippines. Spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said the United States regards the election as a reaffirmation of democracy. The Philippine Congress declared Ramos the winner today after taking more than a month to verify the vote. A strike by Amtrak employees now seems more likely. Today's negotiating session ended without an agreement, and if talks tomorrow were unsuccessful, a walkout could come as early as 1 minute past midnight on Wednesday. John Greenberg has more.
Amtrak is bargaining with 6 unions representing almost 8,000 workers. Jed Dodd, chief negotiator for the Maintenance of Way employees, says the two sides are fairly close on wages, but disagree strongly on what are called the rules of work.
We can work day and night now, weekends for straight time pay, and those are the rules that Amtrak is insisting. It's not efficient enough.
Amtrak officials say changes are necessary in order to keep costs down. Both sides are predicting a strike. If it comes, the Northeast would be affected the most, with many commuter lines serving New York City, Boston, and other large cities facing major disruptions. Two unions may also call a strike on about 40 freight railroads. The effect of that depends on whether non-striking workers honor the union picket lines. For National Public Radio, this is John Greenberg in Washington.
The nation's four biggest airlines said today that they'd pay more than $400 million in cash and ticket vouchers to settle a price-fixing suit. The suit alleged that Delta, American, United, U.S. Air, and other airlines conspired to fix prices through a computerized reservation system. The airlines agreed to settle the suit without admitting liability. The settlement is subject to the approval of a federal judge in Atlanta. The settlement would affect almost anyone who flew to any of 23 hubs after January 1, 1988. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On November 2nd, just one day before Election Day, the trial of Caspar Weinberger is tentatively scheduled to begin. It is a trial expected to offer new information concerning what Ronald Reagan and George Bush knew about the Iran-Contra affair. Weinberger, who was Secretary of Defense under Reagan, is now the highest official indicted in the scandal. Last week, Weinberger pleaded not guilty to five felony charges of lying to Congress about the Iran-Contra affair and concealing his journals documenting the affair. My guest Tom Blanton has written several investigative accounts of the scandal. He filed the Freedom of Information Act request and subsequent lawsuit that forced the U.S. government to release Oliver North's diaries. He's the executive director of the National Security Archive, a library and research institute which documents U.S. foreign policy. The archive provides scholars and journalists, as well as other researchers, with unclassified and declassified government documents. I asked Blanton about the significance of the Weinberger indictment.
The Weinberger indictment is a very big breakthrough because it takes the Iran-Contra investigation right up to the doorstep of Ronald Reagan. And this is despite a five-year effort by then-Reagan administration officials and the Bush administration to keep responsibility for this scandal away from the president. So the real importance is it goes to Reagan. And how so? The key to the indictment hinges around two core secrets of the Iran-Contra scandal that former Secretary of Defense Weinberger is accused of covering up. And these were arms deals to Iran in 1985 and the secret Saudi Arabian funding for the Contras in 84 and 85. And the reason those go right to Reagan's doorstep is in the Saudi case, he personally put the arm on King Fahd at one White House meeting, after which Fahd upped his donation to about $2 million a month. And then on the Iran arms deals in 85, Weinberger himself told the president that these were illegal, that they were against the law. In fact, at one key meeting, Weinberger even ticked off the various laws that were broken by the deals. And the president said, "Well, Cap, the American people would never forgive me if I failed to get those hostages out just because of this legal question." And he brushed it off. And so in that situation, the Secretary of Defense had a couple of options. Here's the president brushing off word of illegal, criminal, against-the-law acts. And Cap could have resigned, and he didn't. He could have, as Oliver North points out in his autobiography, Weinberger had the authority to unilaterally stop the arms deals. He didn't do that either. Instead, he seems to have objected when there were formal meetings about the deals, but the rest of the time kept his mouth shut. And then when the investigators came around and asked him, "Did you keep any notes on these meetings? Did you take any notes on your phone calls? Did you ever write down what the president told you?" Weinberger said, "Notes? What notes? I never kept any notes. Wish I'd kept notes. Would have been a lot easier to write my memoirs." Now we just found out, and the independent counsel has just gotten a hold of about 1,700 pages of these notes, and they include notes on meetings with the president.
Now, the information that you mentioned about the meetings that Weinberger was at and the things he said at the meetings, this comes from information in the indictment, information that comes from Weinberger's journals. Now, what are these journals? Weinberger said he didn't take notes. What are these journals?
It's a very good question. According to the indictment, what happened was Weinberger was asked on four or five different occasions by the Tower Board, by the Congressional Rand-Contra Committees, and by the Independent Counsel to produce any notes, any documents that he had on Iran-Contra related to that in any way. And every time he said, I didn't take any notes. A year and a half ago, according to the indictment, someone at the Pentagon who had worked for Weinberger told the Independent Counsel that Weinberger had these notes. He took them every day. In fact, if you add up the numbers, it's about three or four pages of notes every day, every work day, and that Weinberger hadn't turned them over. And they went back to Weinberger and said, Mr. Weinberger, one of your top aides has said to us you kept these notes. Where are they? Weinberger said, I never kept any notes, and if you don't believe me, well, that's just that. I think at that point they threatened a subpoena, and then Weinberger said, well, my papers are locked under seal over at the Library of Congress. Why don't you go look at them? It's unclear whether they served a subpoena or whether Weinberger just gave them permission under threat of a subpoena. At any rate, they came up with these 1,700 pages, and they're supposedly in his own handwriting, highly illegible. I've seen lots of examples of Weinberger's handwriting in all the other Iran-Contra documents, and it's pretty hard to read. But the key seems to have been that after these core meetings with the president on these two issues, the Saudi funding for the Contras and these illegal arms deals, Weinberger apparently made some notes. None of us have seen those notes. The Independent Counsel has them. We probably won't get to see them until the Weinberger trial occurs.
Now, the indictment outlines the special prosecutor's theory about Weinberger's involvement. Can you outline that theory for us?
It outlines the theory by implication, and that's the interesting thing, because it's a very narrow indictment to some specific actions Weinberger did or didn't do, like covering up the notes, like lying to investigators about these illegal arms deals and about the Saudi contribution. But the implication, because it goes to Reagan's doorstep, the implication is that in late 1986, as the scandal was breaking, the Reagan administration was in a panic. They had just seen their president go on national TV three times in the month of November, and each time lied to the American public. He said things like, we never traded arms for hostages, or, well, we did trade some arms for hostages, but it wasn't really us, it was this third country, Israel. And then he said, oh, all the arms could fit into one little airplane. Well, it turns out all those things were lies. And a lot of these officials had lived through Watergate as mid-level or even high-level officials in the Nixon administration, and they were just frantic because they saw everything their administration had accomplished going down the tubes because of these illegal deals. And so by implication, this indictment of Weinberger says that these guys all got together. Ed Meese, the attorney general, was sort of the leader of the effort. And they created a kind of alternative story to cover up the personal role of President Reagan in these deals. And the alternative story was the one that we all know about this obscure lieutenant colonel on the National Security Council staff named Ollie North doing a diversion from the arms sales over to the Contras. And they went public with the diversion, and they said, here is the scandal. It's a diversion, and it's Ollie's fault, and maybe Poindexter, but the president didn't know, and that's the scandal. And I think the implication of the Weinberger indictment last week was that the diversion was a diversion. It was a cover story. And they were scared to death that Reagan's personal responsibility for these other issues, the Saudi funding for the Contras and the illegal deals in 85, they were scared to death that would come out. And they had to put up an alternative narrative to focus all of our attention and keep it away from the president.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Blanton, and he's the executive director of the National Security Archives in Washington, D.C., which documents U.S. foreign policy. He is the person who filed through the Freedom of Information Act and also filed a lawsuit to get Oliver North's diaries made public. And we're talking about the indictment of Caspar Weinberger. We're going to take a short break and talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is Tom Blanton of the National Security Archives, who has written extensively about the Iran-Contra scandal, and we're discussing the indictment of Caspar Weinberger. Now, you say that this indictment takes the story to the doorstep of the president and the vice president of Reagan and Bush. So, judging from the indictment, what does that lead you to believe that, let's start with Reagan, what does that lead you to believe that Reagan actually knew about the Iran-Contra affair?
Well, what we had before last week was a story that really most resembled a kind of modernist drama, and there was no central knowledge or central character on whom you could place the responsibility for the whole thing. You had lieutenant colonels, and you had Saudi princes, and you had Navy admirals, and you had private entrepreneurs, and you had rogue CIA agents, and you had literally dozens and dozens of these characters wandering on and off the stage, and 26 countries involved in the Contra aid, and this and that deal, and scams, and fakes, and rip-offs. But because the core of that previous story was about the diversion, and that didn't track back to President Reagan, it didn't hang together. I think the American people were really baffled by it in many respects. The writer Francis Fitzgerald came up with a great metaphor, I thought, which was we as Americans had been spoiled by Watergate, because that was Shakespeare. That was Richard Nixon, the mighty brought low by their own hubris. And the problem with Iran-Contra was it was much more like a modernist drama, like a Samuel Beckett, with these characters going all over the place and leads that would fizzle out. And you had a sense that it was really important and really cosmic, but there was no narrative to hang on. And I think, if to continue that metaphor, I think in a strange way, Caspar Weinberger is the Godot that the narrative has been waiting for all this time. It's as if the character walked onto the stage and all of a sudden you have this tragedy beginning to take shape instead of this modernist drama that no one can follow. And the tragedy is that the president himself wanted the Contras kept alive body and soul, and was personally willing to ask King Fahd to put up the money from the Saudi oil riches, and was personally willing to approve arms deals with Iran even when they broke the law. He was so eager to do something to get the hostages out. And so now we've got a sort of a narrative coherency that's just beginning to come together, and part of the tragedy is that it's Caspar Weinberger around whom this narrative is coalescing.
And that's a tragedy because he was somebody who was opposed?
Exactly. Yeah. But he's also somebody who stands accused of covering up this central role that Ronald Reagan played.
What information does the indictment contain about what President Bush, who was the vice president during the Iran-Contra affair, knew?
It has information on one very interesting meeting in November of 86, just before the Reagan administration went public with the scandal, where Bush is in attendance, and Meese, and Reagan, and Shultz, and Weinberger, and all these other characters are there. And Meese announces that the deals in 85 may well have been illegal. And he sort of says, but the president didn't know. And no one at the meeting, including Bush, speaks up, even though the implication is, and the other evidence, all the thousands of other documents tend to show, that the motive force was Ronald Reagan. Every morning at the national security briefing, his various advisors said, Reagan would ask about the hostages. What have we done today to get them out? There was a very clear mandate from Ronald Reagan to go the extra mile, to cut the deals, whatever you had to do. Forget these legal questions. So when you come to that meeting, you have George Bush sitting there. He had also been in a lot of those national security briefings. He had been in on all the key deals, the meetings on the deals during 1986. He knew a lot. He wasn't out of the loop. He was there when Reagan signed the Bible that they sent off to the Ayatollah and so forth. And he kept his mouth shut, like the rest of them. And I think what it comes down to is the great difficulty with assigning blame in this scandal to either Bush or Reagan is they both operated sort of like the Book of the Month Club operates. If you know how that works, you get a catalog in the mail. It has all the books. There's a little postcard in there. You got to send back the postcard to stop the book from coming. Otherwise, it just happens automatically. And what we see from all these documents is Ollie North and Poindexter and the others briefing Reagan and briefing Bush and putting up a catalog of the arms deals and the Contra aid every month and sometimes every week. And neither Bush nor Reagan ever sends back the turndown card.
Bush has said, though, all along that he was intentionally kept out of the loop and he never knew anything.
That's part of the cover story, and he has qualified that statement on several occasions. And I would recommend a close reading of that famous interview he had with Dan Rather, where he said, out of the loop, and Rather says, well, what do you mean? You were at this meeting, you were at that meeting. And Bush says, by out of the loop, I mean not operational. Now, that's George Bush's definition of out of the loop, that he wasn't operational. He didn't carry out any of these operations. But I guess the follow-up question should have been, well, when has any vice president ever been operational? The point about being in the loop or out of the loop is, what'd you know and when'd you know it? And George Bush knew everything that was happening in 1986. He was briefed over and over. He attended all those meetings. I think that, however, you can't track a specific instance like this Weinberger meeting with Reagan where Bush is responsible for authorizing something to have happened. Instead, it's much more this passive kind of Book of the Month Club process. So I think the real ramification for Bush is just simply that it has to be his worst nightmare, that this scandal is still lingering around 5.5 years later, right in an election year, and that this trial may start a couple of days before Election Day. That is not in George Bush's interest at all.
If George Bush was indeed at the meetings in which the Iran-Contra, you know, deal was discussed, can he be indicted for a crime?
I doubt it, because the only time that George Bush testified about any of this stuff was to the Tower Commission. And I think only one indictment's been brought about any cover-up to the Tower Commission, and that was ultimately thrown out. That was a CIA agent named Joe Fernandez. I think that, remember, what Weinberger is being indicted for are two counts of covering up his own notes and three counts of lying to the congressional investigators about these specific illegal arms deals and the Saudi contribution. Now, President Reagan nor George Bush were brought before the congressional committees. President Reagan did testify in the Poindexter trial on videotape. So it's conceivable that a prosecutor could comb through those 8 hours of rambling, disjointed testimony and come up with something to say this is perjury. But that seems somewhat doubtful to me. With Bush, there's not even that raw material. It seems even more doubtful that there would be any specific legal action brought against Bush. But I think the big picture is what is most troubling for Bush in his political sense, which is if the theory the special prosecutor is going with is on target, and if he can prove it in court that the top officials of the administration conspired together to create a cover story, to create a diversion from the core truth, then Bush is tainted by association, even if there's not a specific action which one could place at his doorstep.
Perot offered Iran money for hostages, but that was personal money, and he was not speaking on behalf of the American government. So does
Wrong.
That put him in a different position?
No, it wasn't. He was speaking on behalf of the American government because Ollie North got him to put up the money, and the people who were handling the arrangements were two Drug Enforcement Administration agents. The problem here was is there's a whole series of laws that say government employees can't take private money, can't use private money to pursue government purposes without accounting for it. You can only spend money that's appropriated by Congress. If you take a ransom operation off the books the way Perot funded Oliver North to do, you've basically escaped accountability. You've escaped the Constitution. And you've created this vast slush fund, which Ollie North administered, where diversions were going in all directions. He diverted some of Ross Perot's money to go work on some hostage deals. He diverted some Contra money to work on some hostage deals. Then he diverted money back from the hostage deals to help the Contras. So when you create these fungible slush funds, you're breaking a whole series of laws. And I think worse than that, though, you're saying to the kidnappers and the terrorists of the world, take an American. If the government doesn't give you some tow missiles, we'll get a private citizen like Ross Perot to give you some cash. And these free market advocates like Perot and Oliver North, it's a wonder they don't understand this whole incentive structure gets set up by offering ransom.
How has the indictment of Caspar Weinberger affected the politics surrounding the Iran-Contra investigation and specifically the work of Lawrence Walsh? I mean, for instance, Senator Dole called the prosecutors assassins.
Yes, it's really curious that here we are almost 20 years to the day after Watergate, and special prosecutors are still under attack by the powers that be as on witch hunts or abusing their power and so forth. I think we learned one core lesson from Watergate, which was you couldn't trust the government to investigate itself. You couldn't trust the Justice Department to investigate itself. You couldn't trust the president to investigate himself. And that's why we needed special prosecutors. In this case, it seems clear the independent counsel is trying to justify what is a 5.5-year investigation expenditure of $30 million to investigate Iran-Contra by going after some folks that everybody would see as a big fish, meaning the former Secretary of Defense. And here's the core issue, because people ask the question, is it really worth $30 million? Do people really want to know this? And I think there's only one good answer to that question, which is that I just hope in some future White House, when the Secretary of Defense is sitting around a table with the President of the United States and she's asked to go along with some illegal arms deal that the President really wants to have done, and she says to the President, well, Mr. President, these are illegal, and the President says, well, Ms. Secretary, I want them done, that person will actually stop and think and say, you know, Cap Weinberger got indicted for doing this. And maybe at that point they blow the whistle. And I think that's worth $30 million, that's worth whatever it takes.
Why is it important to you that this investigation continue and that all the information that could possibly come out comes out?
It's because it's so rare that we get a good close look inside these top secret reaches of the national security bureaucracy. I mean, we hardly ever really know what happens in those secret White House meetings until 30 or even 50 years afterwards, when the historians get to pour through the documents and try to figure out, well, who was right, who was wrong, who missed this one. I think what we're about at the National Security Archive, and there are a lot of good journalists and historians around who are trying to do the same kind of work, is make our government more accountable now for decisions that it's made now or in the recent past.
Tom Blanton is the executive director of the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, family values. Marion Wright Edelman has spent the past two decades of her life in service to children. She's the founding president of the Children's Defense Fund, an advocacy group that works for children's health and education. The LA Times has called her the most powerful advocate in America for children. We'll talk about her own upbringing, raising her children, and her new book, The Measure of Our Success, A Letter to My Children and Yours. Also, our commentator Maureen Corrigan tells us what it's like to be back in school and back in a dormitory. She's taking a seminar at Yale this summer with 11 other professors. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled against a so-called hate crime law in St. Paul, Minnesota. The High Court said that states and cities may not outlaw such things as cross-burning because it's a violation of free speech. The court, by a 9-0 vote, ruled against a law that made it a misdemeanor to take part in bias-motivated disorderly conduct either by speech or action. And the U.S. Supreme Court issued a ruling today making it harder for death row inmates to get second and third reviews of their cases. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
In several recent decisions, the High Court has made it more difficult to mount repeated federal challenges to state court convictions. Today's ruling continues that trend. The High Court upheld the death sentence of a Louisiana man convicted of murder and arson. Attorneys for Robert Wayne Sawyer had argued that evidence of his low IQ was not given in his trial, and that with such evidence, at least one juror would have held out for a sentence of life imprisonment. But the court ruled in a 6-3 decision that such evidence at this point in Sawyer's appeal was not enough to overturn his sentence. Supporters of the court's strict standard note that it does not apply to an inmate's first round of appeals, only later reviews. Opponents of the death penalty say it makes it increasingly difficult to correct fundamental miscarriages of justice in death penalty cases. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
The fighting in Moldova pits Russian forces against local forces and Russian separatists against the Russian-speaking new nation. In Washington, the State Department is calling for a peaceful settlement and asking Russia to pull out its troops and the government of Moldova to protect the Russian minority. Barry Schwide reports.
Less than a week ago, Russian President Boris Yeltsin and President Bush signed a new charter of friendship in Washington. One of the main provisions was that ethnic flare-ups in Europe be settled peacefully through the mechanism of the European Security Conference. That principle is likely to be reinforced at the summit next month of the 51-nation conference in Helsinki, with the two presidents attending. The fighting in Moldova puts both presidents on the spot right now, Yeltsin especially. He wants to protect the Russians in the former sister Soviet republic, but he's committed to settling and even preventing ethnic conflicts in a large European framework. So far, the Bush administration isn't making great demands on Yeltsin, but it also isn't backing away from the summit agreement, and it would like to see the Russian army leave Moldova. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Officials of the European Community have agreed on a plan to take away all government restrictions on airfares. A spokesman says under this agreement, EC air carriers will be able to offer services on domestic runs in another member state after a transition. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 4 points. This is NPR News. According to news reports from Bosnia, at least 8 people were killed and 80 others injured in a Serbian attack on Sarajevo. Radio reports from the capital say a series of mortar attacks occurred as residents looked for food during a break in the fighting. A UN official who is trying to get planes of food and medicine to the area called the shelling a major setback to be condemned in the strongest possible terms. In order to reopen the airport, there has to be a break of 48 hours in the fighting, and it's feared that unless help comes soon, many people will starve to death. The Food and Drug Administration has approved a new drug for patients with advanced cases of AIDS. The FDA's announcement was part of a fast-track drug approval program to help patients with life-threatening diseases. Rick McCourt reports.
The FDA approved the use of the drug known as DDC in combination with the already approved AIDS medicine AZT. Two small studies of people with severe cases of AIDS showed that this combination therapy increased the number of AIDS-fighting immune cells in the bloodstream. and this immune system boost lasted for more than a year in some cases. But researchers don't know whether DDC actually helps patients live longer or prevents the infections that kill AIDS patients. Normally, such drug tests take up to 2 years to complete, but FDA Commissioner David Kessler said that the results were encouraging enough to approve the therapy after less than a year of study. He also said that if ongoing trials failed to prove that the combined therapy actually keeps patients from getting sicker, he would retract the approval. For National Public Radio, this is Rick McCourt in Washington.
President Bush has signed a $1 billion aid package approved by Congress in the wake of rioting in Los Angeles. The plan also benefits concerns in Chicago damaged by flooding and offers funding for teenage jobs this summer to be managed by the Labor Department. The Senate had approved a $2 billion version, but this met opposition from the White House. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Children have no vote, but they have a powerful advocate in Marion Wright Edelman. Edelman is the founding president of the Children's Defense Fund. For more than 20 years, she's worked for child health, education, child care, and youth employment, as well as teen pregnancy prevention and strengthening family support systems. We talked about the values her parents instilled in her growing up black in the segregated South, and the values she's tried to pass on to her children. This is also the subject of her new book, The Measure of Our Success, A Letter to My Children and Yours. In the book, she writes, "I worry about the effects of my sometimes difficult, even frantic efforts to balance my responsibility to you, my children, and to other people's children to whom you must share school, streets, the nation, and the world. Paradoxically, the more I worried about and wanted for you, the more I worried about the parents of children who have so much less." I asked Edelman about the tough choices this has forced her to make.
Well, you know, these are things that every working mother knows. Some of us, though, have an extra set of choices. I mean, I've always been my own boss. But, you know, when you have an important set of meetings and you get up in the morning to head to those meetings and find that one of your children is sick, you know, I stay home. I cancel those meetings and take the risk that somebody will say that I'm unreliable because I don't like leaving my children at home when they're sick. I know that many other parents don't have that choice. And so, you know, while I have found it difficult as a middle-class parent with all of the supports, with a husband, with a live-in housekeeper for the first 12 years of my children's lives, being my own boss, it has still been very difficult for me to juggle. And I've always had enough money because we've been able to figure out what we could do without. We've always had enough books. We've always had enough food. We've always had shelter over our head. And when I think of what it must be like if you were a single parent or a teenage parent or you had handicapped kids or you had no health insurance, I don't know how many parents make it. And so I am enraged that our country does not make sure that parents and children have what they need. And that has to be a priority for our nation.
Now, you mentioned that for the first 12 years of your life as a mother, that you had a live-in housekeeper. Were you ever kind of embarrassed or ambivalent about that? And I ask that because I think a lot of middle-class people who can afford it but realize how many people can't are very self-conscious about doing it.
No, I'm not ambivalent about that. And Miss Amy is somebody that my mother sent me. She grew up in my hometown, knew me before I was born. And she was not a mother substitute, but she was a very important supplement. And since I've always felt that I had something to contribute, even though my children came first, I was very happy to have that support. I'm not defensive about it. I wish other people had the same choices.
Mm-hmm. In your book, A Letter to My Sons, you write, "I hope you will always recognize your dual heritage as the special gift and blessing that it is." Your husband is white. You're African American. Did you always see that dual heritage as a gift and a blessing, or were you worried about it at first, you know, for your children?
Well, my husband is white and Jewish, and the religious differences, I think, were more difficult for us than the racial differences. You don't marry races, you marry individuals. We're growing up in a world that is increasingly diverse, that is two-thirds non-white. These children come from two peoples, Jews and blacks, who have withstood the worst that the world can hold. And I happen to think, by my standards, that to have been in recent years enslaved and not slavers is something to be proud of. And so I hope that my children will grow up respecting all kinds of differences, respecting other people, because they have seen that mutual respect in our house. They have seen Christian and Jew be able to coexist. They have seen black and white coexist and indeed build a community. And that is something that I hope will give them greater strength as we try to teach the world more tolerance.
And you said it was the religious more than the racial differences that you were concerned about. As you mentioned, your husband is Jewish. Your father was a Baptist minister. So how did you handle religion in the house when your sons were growing up?
Well, they went to church with me every Sunday, but they also, when they began to approach adolescence, went to Hebrew school and went through a bar mitzvah in our backyard, what I call a Baptist bar mitzvah, where both sides of the family came together, because the message that we wanted to convey to them is that whether we're Jews or Christians, that we do believe spiritually that there is something outside of ourselves that is more important than ourselves. And I don't know what choices they will make eventually about either or religion, but I do hope that whatever choices they make, that they will be spiritual human beings and know that there is a God there.
As someone who has been a longtime activist in the civil rights movement, I mean, you started in the civil rights movement in the 60s, was it considered a stigma at all to marry a white person?
Well, I didn't marry a white person. I married an individual
that I happen to love.
And so that I don't know what other people considered it. I've never thought it was anybody's business whom I married, just as I never consider it my business whom they marry. And so that I never asked permission. I've never asked people's opinions. And I have not found, whatever, I have not sort of found that it has been an impediment. I don't know what many blacks or many whites think, but I really frankly haven't paid a lot of attention to that.
Did you used to hear your father preach all the time?
Every Sunday.
Uh-huh. What was his style like?
My father was a very quiet man. He was not an emotional man. He was a teacher. And I have lots of his sermons, which I read. A lot of what you will find in my book is a reflection of him. But he taught. But most importantly, he lived what he preached. He was a true servant. He believed deeply in education. He believed deeply in reading. He had a study that I relish even today, which was like a bulletin board into the whole world. I mean, we always had books in our house. We didn't have a lot of clothes, but we always had the complete works of Mark Twain, or we always had great biographies of great men and women like Gandhi or a Reinhold Niebuhr. So my father was just a great teacher, but more importantly, a great example. He believed in service. He believed in finding a way out of nowhere when we could not go sit down at drugstore lunch counters. He built a canteen behind our church for black kids when there were no black homes for the aged. He built one across the street, and all of our family had to help out. When there were kids who didn't have homes, our home was open to them. And so, you know, he just was an extraordinary example and a quiet minister and pastor. My brother has followed in his footsteps as a minister. My nephew, my brother's son, is now a minister. And that ethic of service and achievement and of hard work and a belief that we can change the world is one that is carried on through his kids and his grandkids, and I'm deeply grateful for him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Marion Wright Edelman. She is the founder and director of the Children's Defense Fund and the author of a new book called A Letter to My Sons. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Marion Wright Edelman is my guest, the founder of the Children's Defense Fund. You were, when you were in college, getting active in the civil rights movement. What was a turning point for you that helped make you an activist or keep you an activist?
Oh, I went abroad my junior year to the University of Geneva. And it was the first time I had ever had a chance to be out of the South. And to look back at America, and that was an era when the civil rights movement was just beginning. And once I had tasted freedom as a young black girl who had grown up in a segregated South, I knew that I could never come back into the South and with its restrictions. And happily in 1960, when I returned home to Spelman College in Atlanta, the civil rights movement began. That was when the sit-ins began, and my first plane ride was to Shaw University in Raleigh to form the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And Dr. King was there, and we did it under his auspices. So that junior and senior year in college were terribly important.
You ended up going to law school. Did you think that law was what was needed in the civil rights movement? Did you think that that's how you could play your greatest part?
That's why I did choose to go to law school. It never occurred to me that I was going to be a lawyer. I was a music major, and then I was going to go into the Foreign Service. But after the sit-in movement, and I got all caught up in the civil rights movement in 1960, I volunteered at the local NAACP office in Atlanta, and I was stunned at how many complaints had come before that local NAACP office from poor blacks that did not get taken care of because white lawyers at that time, most of them would not take civil rights cases. Most people did not have money. And so I had to ask myself, what am I doing thinking about going off to a Russian institute at Georgetown when what is needed is a lawyer, are lawyers? And so on the spur of the moment, I decided to go to law school. I have no intrinsic interest in the law, but it was the instrument that was needed. And I chose later, after getting out of Yale Law School, to move to Mississippi, because there were only 3 black lawyers to serve 900,000 black people in the state at that time, 2 of whom had never gone to law school.
No, you were the first black woman admitted to the Mississippi Bar.
I was the first black woman admitted to the Mississippi Bar, and the first time I went into federal court into a conference and walked in, you could have heard a pin drop, and none of the men in the room, all white, would shake my hand, but I wasn't clear whether it was because I was black or it was because I was a woman who had stumbled in on this ancient club, but eventually that, too, gave way to change.
Now, how did your work in the civil rights movement lead you to work for children's rights?
Well, it really, one thing was very clear as a civil rights lawyer, that if I worked as I did to desegregate the schools in many counties in Mississippi, but the next day, if the mothers of the children who had desegregated the schools and their fathers were kicked off their plantations and had no jobs and had no place to live and had no food to eat, that my job as a lawyer did not kind of end there. And secondly, it became very clear, even in the first year in Mississippi, that political and civil rights would never have real meaning unless you put the substantive and economic underpinnings under people which would allow them to exercise those rights. And so in the second summer of my sojourn in Mississippi, the Head Start program came after the state of Mississippi refused to take it. Civil rights groups and church groups applied for it and got it. And to watch those poor parents beginning to get involved in educating their children's lives and getting a new sense of possibility and realizing that their children were entitled to health care and to other services and to see themselves represented in textbooks and to have high expectations by their teachers was a wonderful experience. And so it was out of Head Start and out of recognizing that political and economic and social rights had to go together that led me to form the Children's Defense Fund, you know, eventually.
You've written that working women, working middle-class women, have made child care and children's issues a middle-class issue. How has that helped you in your work?
It changed the politics because, again, you know, we have not tended to care about the poor or to care about other people as much as we should in our country. And it's only when problems hit us on our front door that we began to care. And because child care, with the majority of mothers having to go into the workforce to stay where we are, has become a middle-class issue, that changed the politics. As drugs and violence has begun to permeate a range of neighborhoods, that begins to sort of, you know, get other people who have political clout and who do vote and who do have access to political leaders, that begins to sort of change the politics. As 37 million Americans see what it means not to have health insurance, that begins to change that politics. The people in New Hampshire who didn't care very much about food stamps or about welfare and thought it could never happen to them, but when their factories closed and they found themselves in the food stamp lines and they are white and New Hampshians, they began to understand these are not other people's problems. And so the problems of children and families, that has got to be what we address in the 90s. And now, because enough whites and enough middle-class folk are affected by that, I think we'll begin to get those changes.
There's something I want you to straighten out for me. I was reading a New Yorker profile of you from a couple of years ago, and Roger Wilkins, the columnist and civil rights activist, said that early on in your days as the head of the Children's Defense Fund, you asked him to take it over, and you said, we need a strong black man. We need the image of a strong black man in a role like this. What happened?
Well, he turned me down, unfortunately. He's a very gifted and talented man who went on to win the Pulitzer as an editorial writer during Watergate for the Washington Post. I grew up with a strong tradition of strong black men. And it saddens me to hear and see so many say that our black males are not pulling their weight or can't make it. I'm the mother of three black sons, and I have known those strong role models, and I know black men who can do everything. I grew up in an era not only of my father, but of Dr. King, of Benjamin Mays. When I was in college, there was Whitney Young and Carl Holman. But I thought at that time, because we were beginning to see more single parents, and because the role of the black man was becoming a little bit more tenuous with less opportunity, that it was important to have a strong male image, and we now have many strong black men working at the Children's Defense Fund. But I was at that time very impressed with Roger's talents and with his image and with his background, and thought that he would be more effective than I would be. And I'm sorry he didn't take the job.
You were willing to hand your job over to somebody else?
I was willing to hand the title over. I still do my work. I think we're here to serve. And one of the things that my father and mother taught me, that you can get an awful lot done in this world if you don't worry about who gets the credit. And we need more servant leaders. We need more people who are willing to do the hard scut work. And social change and big change is not about who's out front. It's about all those people who work quietly every day behind the scenes. I have always been greatly flattered when my words that I struggle with come out into the mouths of people who are well known. If we want to win for children, you're trying to enable and empower other people to carry those messages. And the point is not me. The point is not the Children's Defense Fund. The point is results for children.
I want to get back to your new book, A Letter to My Sons. All parents want their children to have everything that they can and to have everything that the parents didn't have when they were growing up. But you also wanted to make sure, I'm sure, that your sons weren't spoiled by having more and that your sons had some kind of political and social awareness about the more privileged environment they were growing up in. So how did you balance, as a mother, giving them the things that you wanted them to have and making sure that they had a political, social consciousness about the people who didn't have as much?
Well, that's a hard thing. But again, I think you do that by how you live. And I have worried a lot that my children had too much. I took them to church every Sunday morning and in a black church in Washington, D.C., in the middle of the ghetto, so that they could begin to see what other people live like. We try to create service opportunities, but they should see us doing that service. And so you try to live in a way that your children can see what the world is about and not think that their narrow slice of that world is what other children live with. And so I still worry. But the book, again, is a reminder to them, because I had been so worried that I had tried to protect them against all the things I did not have as a child growing up as a black kid in the South, that I may not have made clear to them all the more important things I did have as a black child growing up in the South. It was the ethic of hard work. It was an understanding that you couldn't take anything for granted. It was, most importantly, an understanding that what life was about. And so one hopes that they will pick up the values by how parents live and by, hopefully, an ethic of service that they have seen all around them.
Marian Wright Edelman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marian Wright Edelman is the president of the Children's Defense Fund. Her new book is The Measure of Our Success, A Letter to My Children and Yours. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on the presidential campaign?
All of the candidates were supposed to be at the Conference of Mayors today, Terry, but only Governor Bill Clinton actually did appear, and he unveiled his economic plan to the mayors. It represents something of a shift in emphasis away from tax cuts for the middle class and toward investment in infrastructure and that sort of thing. We'll have an economist in to talk about it. Noah Adams' piece from his trip to Alaska is coming up on the tunnel under the Bering Straits. We'll also have a look at the issues in the Israeli election, which is coming up tomorrow.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The term cultural elite has been in the news almost every day, ever since Vice President Quayle used it earlier this month. Commentator Maureen Corrigan is spending her summer at a bastion of cultural elitism, Yale University. And she's confused. If this is where the cultural elite congregate, shouldn't it be a little more opulent?
I have fond memories of living in a dorm at college during the mid-70s, but not because of the carefree sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I went to a Jesuit university, so we were all either inhibited or guilt-ridden. The dorm I lived in was cheerfully called Martyr's Court, after those Catholic missionaries who'd been dismembered by the heathen they were hoping to convert. Now, I know that somehow Madonna has transformed crosses into erotic art, but believe me, when you're 18, Catholic, and very earnest, having a giant cross outside your dorm window scares away the libido just as sure as it would scare away vampires. No, for me, the most exciting thing about living in a dorm was those bull sessions when my roommates and I would discuss books, ideas, politics, life, and sex in the abstract. I remember being up till 3 in the morning, drinking instant coffee, eating cheese whiz sandwiches, and just talking, 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 until reluctantly we'd all go to bed. Well, this summer I'm living in a dorm again. I'm on a fellowship at Yale, taking a seminar on history and detective fiction, along with 11 other college professors. Most of us are living in the same dorm, and after 1 week, I can report that we're even staying up late discussing books. But that's mostly because nobody's getting much sleep in their narrow dormitory cot with its rusty springs. Also, there's been a confirmed mouse sighting down the hall, so some of us are afraid to be alone in the dark. You tend to forget the grim realities of institutional living and institutional food after you've left college. One of my colleagues was so misled by the grandeur of Yale's dining hall, she got on the cafeteria line and asked for a cappuccino. Dream on. But as a daughter of the working class, I also came to Yale ready to be awed. Sure, I went to another Ivy League university for grad school, but no place else, with the exception of Harvard, quite measures up. Yale is it, the real thing. So I expected the sheer force of centuries of intellectual tradition to radiate out from its gray stone battlements. But on the campus tour, I found out that most of Yale's buildings are as authentic as Sleeping Beauty's castle in Disneyland. They were built in the 1930s and sprayed with acid to give them that medieval Oxbridge look. The only genuine features of these buildings are the gargoyles that were carved during the Depression by WPA workers. The workers understandably resented the rich college kids, so they got their revenge by carving gargoyles that were sly caricatures of Yale students. My favorite gargoyle is of a student dozing over a book whose inside pages read, "You are a joke." Now, don't get me wrong. I'm a really grateful member of the cultural elite, delighted to be spending my summer here. But so far, I've learned one lesson that wasn't on the original course syllabus. When my husband came up for the weekend, I discovered that sharing a dorm cot with someone you love is only a thrill when you're very, very young and you've just decided to defy the squeaking springs and the crosses.
Maureen Corrigan entered week 2 at Yale today. She'll return to teaching English at Georgetown University this fall. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Richard Parker and Thad Kirk. Roberta Shurrock directs the show, with assistance today from Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
He's neurotic, self-centered, and devious. No job, no girlfriend. He's also one of the funniest characters on TV. On the next Fresh Air, creating the character of George Costanza on the series Seinfeld. We'll talk with actor Jason Alexander. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.